On this episode of Skeptico, Steve Volk and I discuss his new book, Fringeology. But at the same time, I look at the mystery and I look at your experience with the ghost in your house. And at the end of the day, in the book, you come away and say, well, it's a mystery.
It is.
Well, that word is tricky again, because it could mean two things. I mean, it could appeal to a certain group of people and they could say, okay, well, we don't know if it really happened. It's a mystery. Or another group of people could process it and say, oh, it's a mystery. You know, we don't know the precise confluence of paranormal things that happened to cause it. Are we really using a word that doesn't get us to the underlying real question mark of the mystery?
I explore the idea of it having been a traditional sort of ghost, along with a range of skeptical explanations, right? From the fantasy-prone personality, which is really a purely psychological one, to what I consider the sort of more exotic materialist theories, like Vic Tandy's theory of infrasound, that there are these sound waves below the level of human hearing that can, you know, cause us to even have visual hallucinations, all on through Persinger and the electromagnetic energy temporal lobe interaction that he's been pursuing for a while now. And I wanted to just put them all out on the table, right? Because I think that they all have some sort of validity. I think we need to be willing to consider all these possibilities.
Stay with us for Skeptico. Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, I have an interview, finally, with Steve Volk. I've been trying to nail this guy down for months. Actually, he's been a guest host here on Skeptico, as many of you know, and he's brought us some interesting interviews. But his new book, Fringeology, challenged me in a number of ways, and I really wanted to have it out with Steve. Here's the interview. We're joined today by someone you've gotten to know over the last few episodes of Skeptico, as Steve Volk has been a guest host here and brought us three very informative, insightful interviews about the history of parapsychology, neurotheology, and ghosts. But today, Steve is here to talk about his new book, Fringeology, a book that covers all these topics and a lot more. Steve, welcome to Skeptico.
Alex, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really great to have you on. The book is really fantastic. I really enjoyed it. And of course, we've really primed the pump on this little discussion we're going to have. So I'm looking forward to getting into some of these things with you.
I was going to say, maybe we should stop right at it's great.
Okay.
Let's just call it there. Thank you very much, Alex. Good times.
Well, of course, we're not going to do that.
I know.
But first, I wanted to let people know, you know, I really did genuinely like the book. And one of the things I thought was really, really great about it is you're an investigative journalist and you really brought that kind of sensibility to this book. And I love the way you dug into these topics, topics that aren't covered nearly enough, of course, but you dug into them and you brought us a whole bunch of new information. I mean, you take Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, one of the opening chapters in the book. I mean, wow. Whoever knew that she was the real originator, the first NDE researcher? And you chronicle all that and do a great job of doing it. And then you add to it the story of how she falls into a spiritualist cult out here in San Diego. And I mean, it just adds this depth and a twist and turn that makes it read like a novel. So congratulations. Tell us a little bit about maybe Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, for example, and what you found most interesting about that story and what it was like as it unfolded for you.
Well, I found this story to be kind of tragic because on a personal level, and I get into this in some in the book, I mean, I have a lot of dead relatives and a couple of them died after extended illnesses, including my mother. And I really got to see firsthand, you know, through reading on death and dying, actually a couple times over the years, that was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross' big book that just sort of sparked the whole hospice care movement. In contrasting the way patients were treated there with the way my mother and my family were treated as my mother died, I got to really see what a valuable contribution she made. And knowing that in the background of all this, she had been having these experiences with near-death experience, which it didn't even have a name at that point. I mean, Raymond Moody coined that phrase and published the book Life After Life 6 years later, you know, after On Death and Dying. So there she is in the mid-60s encountering these kinds of events, and she has no frame of reference for them. She doesn't know where to put them. She doesn't know what to do with them. And so I thought that story was poignant for a couple of reasons. Number one, it shows you that near-death experience, and guys like Michael Shermer still want to put this down to like wishful thinking at times, or the power of suggestion. And that explanation simply doesn't wash, because, you know, she was having these experiences independently. Another person I chronicle in that chapter, Diane Corcoran, at the time a military nurse in the mid-60s, way before Raymond Moody, is having these experiences. So this stuff is real. I put that in quotes. You know, something real is happening. And she didn't know what it was. And I think she walked away from that to some extent with a kind of damaged filter. And that's why she was able to be taken in by a psychic and a con man later. So she had this real mysterious experience, and that left her wanting more.
Maybe. I just do think that the part at the end with the con artist, spiritualist, maybe you want to go into that a little bit, but the guy was really purely a con artist in the worst sense, and
yeah,
faked her into thinking that he was connecting with these spirits from beyond. And to me, that just adds such a depth to the overall story that we're all struggling with when we reach towards the paranormal, when we reach towards something that might lie beyond what we are. And it's something, you know, we've tried to explore on this show, is that, you know, whenever you think you have your arms around this, or whenever you think you have a simple answer,
right,
look out, because it's going to turn around and get you. And we do have to live in what I thought was so interesting, and what we tried to explore lately on this show, is how what we really have to do is have one foot in each world, one foot in this world that is the consensus reality, which I keep saying, which is what everyone else tells us is, hey, that's real, that isn't. And we have to hold on to that. And at the same time, we have to reach for something more, which in Elizabeth Kubler-Ross does seem like someone who was trying to do both.
Yeah, that's why I started with her, is because what's interesting is she wasn't trying to find something more originally. Like, that something more found her. She was dealing with the world as it came to her, right? And the funny part is, what came to her was this reality of how the terminally ill were being neglected in hospitals. And that was her focus. But this other stuff, right, this paranormal stuff, came along with it. And I wanted to start with her then as a kind of cautionary tale, because on one level, it shows you that you can be minding your own business with your feet squarely in this world, and this stuff may show up, right? And then what you do from there is tricky. And she ended up with too open a mind, as it were, and got taken in by this guy. And so I do feel like it's important for people to keep that stuff in mind. And in the time I was researching the book, as I was spending a lot of time with a ghost hunter in particular, and I saw sort of the people in his orbit, I saw people who were, you know, way too eager to ascribe any unexplained sound to, you know, a disembodied spirit. I mean, and that's just, that's ridiculous. But their filter got damaged somewhere along the way. And that's what I think about Kubler-Ross. I think she encountered so much, as I'd put it, true weirdness, right, that she became vulnerable to anyone who'd come along and say that I tapped it into it in this way, and I can show you how to have repeatable paranormal experiences, which is what this guy Jay Barnum did. He came along and said, yeah, you know, you had these experiences spontaneously, but we do these all the time at our spiritualist church.
Yep. Okay, enough playing nice, because you've just led me into.
I just want to say real quick, that was 8 minutes and 45 seconds of playing nice. If that's too much, well, okay.
No, you've actually led me into one of the issues I wanted to talk about, because it kept coming up for me when I was reading Fringeology, and that's that you seem to be advocating for this middle ground. You do it right from the introduction, and it seems to be a theme that keeps coming up. Can't we find a middle here, is what you seem to be saying over and over again. And I guess the way that that plays into the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross story and many of the other stories that we're going to talk about here is that really the middle ground? Is the middle ground really between the huckster con artist in San Diego from the Spiritualist Church and the genuine near-death experiences that she studied. It seems to me that rather than a middle there, we have to juggle two realities.
Yeah, I mean, the middle would be somewhere between those sorts of things, right? The middle would be between the...
No, there is that, and that's, I guess, what I'm saying. Let me shift, if I can, that to parapsychology, because it's another topic, psi and telepathy. It's a topic you cover really, really nicely in the book. And, you know, the net of it that I read is that, hey, you looked into the parapsychology research, Dean Radin's research, Jessica Utz's analysis statistically of the meta-analysis, and you say, hey, this stuff is real. There's a real phenomena there that these guys are reporting. Their methods are really quite good, better than science as a whole. And then you look at the skeptical side and you say, these guys are not very good. The skeptics and the people that oppose them are not playing fair, are not doing good research, have not put up a credible explanation or counter-explanation for it. And then at the end, you seem to, again, seek, okay, so there's some middle ground here. Well, what's the middle ground? The big leap, the big story is telepathy is real. Taking it back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the big story is consciousness does survive death. Now, how we sort out the other part of that, the other game that the other side is playing, to me seems like a separate issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, a lot of times where I was seeing question marks, you're seeing exclamation points. You know what I mean? Like, so where you're seeing a conclusive case having been made, I see myself having pushed this from the more materialist, you know, skeptical stance where we already know that we've already explained this stuff away, right? This is all the product of superstition. To me, pushing it back to, hey, wait a second, there's something really worth discussing here. And so I think I do spend a lot of time pushing back against the skeptics because they're not often critically evaluated, right? I mean, they just sort of put forward something that sounds about right, and people don't consider their claim as critically as they consider the original paranormal claim, or even really very critically at all, right? And so I wanted to break down what their explanations for this stuff are and what some of their motivations might be. And I found that there's severe reason to doubt them. But that to me didn't make it so that I walk around feeling like, hey, I know near-death experiences are real, or I know telepathy is real. I just feel like these things have a lot more to recommend them than we're commonly told, and that we need to keep working at it.
Right. And that may be true from a common sense man on the street standpoint. But I think if we look at this through the lens of science, I think what you're really advocating is much more revolutionary, because in science, we don't know anything. We're just moving from theory to theory, and one suggests another. And from that, we form a paradigm that becomes our scientific worldview. And I would suggest that what you put forward is quite revolutionary. If one was just to accept your finding, one would have to say, mind does not equal brain, consciousness survives bodily death in some way we don't understand. We don't understand the implications of it. We don't understand what that means. We don't even understand what consciousness is. But clearly the data is strongly suggesting that some kind of consciousness is extending beyond our bodily death. That is paradigm shifting. And I would suggest to you that you're really saying the same thing when you look at psi and you say, hey, I've gone through the data, and yes, Dean Radin is right. Well, that changes everything. And I just guess I didn't feel like you were quite willing to really accept the full implications of that finding, the finding that you do document in the book.
You know, I guess for me, and it's funny, I went ahead and just jotted this down as you were saying it. I mean, I feel like I'm saying not that mind doesn't equal brain, but that mind very well may not equal brain, right? Consciousness may very well survive death. I really felt like I was emerging from these things with question marks, personally.
But I'm just going to, I got to hammer on that same point.
Please do.
And that's that personally, you may not have reached a level of confidence where you would be willing to go there. But I would suggest to you that the way science is played, the way the game is, when you are piling up all the evidence on one side and kind of undermining all the evidence on the other side. That would cause the paradigm shift. And the only thing keeping it up is more kind of sociological, cultural issues that you kind of explore in the book. But from a scientific standpoint, if we're just looking at the data, you provide all the data on one side, you undermine the data on the other side. It's really case closed. And in terms of there being question marks, again, there's always going to be question marks. And we don't know. We don't know in what way all this stuff happens. But it seems to me like you make a much stronger case than you kind of conclude at the end of it.
I'm content with that. I mean, and what I mean by that, Alex, is like, look, I mean, for me, the book's both personal and it's public, right? And so you're going to see some of both in there. You're going to see where my own personal head is to some extent. That's unavoidable, right? As much as I wanted to avoid that, you can't. And I don't think there's any such thing as complete objectivity. I felt a great responsibility, right, to be measured in what I say. And I also felt that that's what I kept finding. I kept finding more reason to feel like I was in touch with some sense of mystery rather than more reason to feel I was within something that would give me certainty. This may be too high a bar that I placed on all this, Alex, but for both paranormal and skeptical claims, I just thought, well, can I claim to know this the same way I can claim to know gravity, that when I drop the pen I'm holding in my hand, it is going to fall to the ground? And, you know, we're not there.
Isn't that a great example? Because, as you know, when you drop the pen to the ground, it doesn't fall to the ground, right? I mean, gravity works. As Einstein showed us, there's all these relative forces in play, and it isn't just the Earth pulling on the pen, but it so happens that the moon is pulling on the pen and all the other planets are pulling on the pen and the universe is pulling. So it's exactly that. It's the illusion that we have of a reality like gravity, when science then reveals that that isn't really reality. That's just a close enough approximation. And I would say that kind of gets to this point that we're talking about here, and it gets to the point of the mystery, you know, because the mystery thing can kind of cut two ways. And I think in the book, you do a very nice job of being very open and presenting both the personal angle and the public angle in a very upfront way that I connected with and felt that you were totally trying to tell me where you were coming from. But at the same time, I look at the mystery and I look at your experience with the ghost in your house, which is kind of one of the driving forces through the book, and it comes up over and over again. What happened to you when you were a kid growing up and you guys experienced this poltergeist phenomena. And at the end of the day in the book, you come away and say, well, it's a mystery.
It is.
Well, but that word is tricky again, because it could mean two things. I mean, it could appeal to a certain group of people and they could say, okay, well, we don't know if it really happened. It's a mystery. Or another group of people could process this and say, oh, it's a mystery. You know, we don't know the precise confluence of paranormal things that happened to cause it. Are we really using a word that doesn't get us to the underlying real question mark of the mystery?
Yeah. I think in the totality of that chapter, right, with the fact that I explore the idea of it having been a traditional sort of ghost, along with a range of skeptical explanations, right? From the fantasy-prone personality, which is really a purely psychological one, to what I consider the sort of more exotic materialist theories, like Vic Tandy's theory of infrasound, that there are these sound waves below the level of human hearing that can, you know, cause us to even have visual hallucinations, all on through Persinger and the electromagnetic energy temporal lobe interaction that he's been pursuing for a while now. There's this range of potential explanations, right, from the traditional spook or specter on through who knows what, right? I was on Coast to Coast AM last week, and, you know, they're talking about interdimensional beings and shadow people, right? So there's all these, you know, sort of more far out possibilities. And then there's this, there's on the other end of the spectrum, right, there's this usual skeptical explanation, which is creaking floorboards and superstition do all the work. And then in the middle, what's interesting is that the potential other range of explanations, these maybe naturalistic explanations that detail these sort of complicated interactions between people and their environment. And I wanted to just put them all out on the table, right? Because I think that they all have some sort of validity. I think we need to be willing to consider all these possibilities. And I suppose in that respect, Alex, I mean, I might appear a little bit of a gadfly at times, right? Because I'm challenging everyone to look at all the possibilities all the way on through. And I suppose that from a reader's perspective, that may seem at times like, well, you know, pin yourself down, man, like, you know, plant your flag in the ground somewhere and stand there. But the truth is, Alex, I think that doing that is false. I don't think that we have enough information to plant our flag in the ground and stand particularly anywhere in relation to that.
At the risk of kind of hammering at the same point.
Sure.
I think that reframes the problem in a way that is different than the way the science frames it. And that's that, you know, if we go back to near-death experience, or let's stick with the poltergeist phenomena, if we find one case that defies the materialistic explanation, well, then we're into this other realm that I'm talking about, this paradigm shift that mind does not equal brain. And clearly, I just don't know how any reasonable person could look at your case and fit that into a materialistic box. Whatever kind of pursing or other kind of
infrasound, right?
Infrasound, whatever. It just doesn't fit. It's just not reasonable. So we can have a lot of question marks in terms of, as I said, the precise confluence of paranormal things that we don't understand. But we've jumped the chasm. We're into this other realm of our mind is more than just our brain. And there's some others, and it's highly suggestive that our consciousness, as we think of it, isn't confined to a here now consciousness. That's revolutionary.
I think for me, and you and I maybe have discussed this a little bit in the background, right? This idea of cognitive dissonance being almost a good option. I mean, if you look at my family ghost story, I was 6 when it happened. As I write in the book, I have vivid memories of it. They're sort of fragmented, you know, because they're old memories, but they feel as real as anything else feels to me in my memory. And yet it's very hard for me to figure out how to contextualize or frame those things. And I also have to be aware that memory is highly suggestible, even among adults. Childhood memories in particular are suggestible. I mean, there's been good research on this. So my own memories of this event may in fact be false.
Yeah, but Steve, it's much more compelling that the rest of your family had the same experiences. And moreover, you interview the people who lived in your home after you did without tipping them off. And they say, yeah, we thought it was haunted too. So, I mean, that's...
Yeah. And look, I mean, it if you're pushed to a place by the book where you're thinking, wow, there's definitely more here than meets the eye, right? Something is going on here beyond what we're told in science 101 classes, I'm all right with that, right? But to define it strictly beyond that, I think is very, very difficult to do, right? And I think in the case of my family ghost in particular, I don't really know what to do with it. I love and trust my family, right? I believe their account, but it doesn't fit into my experience of the world. And so I remain open to various explanations for it. But have I yet heard an explanation that fits squarely into the materialist box, as you put it, where I go, yep, you know, that's the one? No, I haven't heard an explanation like that. And I don't know that one exists.
Right.
But neither do I see fit to go around now saying ghosts are real, because it raises a whole other question. What are ghosts? And is it possible, right? Is it possible that ghosts do represent some kind of odd interaction between the environment and the living person, and not something having to do with some, you know, disembodied entity? That's entirely possible. I look, like I said, I know that could be frustrating, but I'm open to all these explanations.
Hey, that's cool. And I'm open to being frustrated, you know?
Yeah, well, you know what? That's kind of your job on Skeptico. And may I say, by the way, too, Alex, one of the things that really influenced me in the writing of this is that I did go out for a little more than a year with a ghost hunter in the Philadelphia area. And the majority of people we met had absolutely nothing going on in their house but misinterpreted natural sounds as ghostly, right?
Right.
And so I did see where skeptics walk away with this idea that this explains what's going on, right?
Right.
I don't think it's enough to explain what's going on, but by any stretch, but it probably does explain the vast majority of cases.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that also points out, you know, something that, you know, we've talked a little bit about here, but without giving the skeptics too much credit, but there is a service to be done in exposing, one, fraudulent people, but two, just the natural tendency that we all have to misperceive things. So, you know, if skeptics were nothing more than this Better Business Bureau for ghost hunters and for psychics, you know, that'd be fine.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I just want to make a quick point here, by the way, too. I think that when you talk about skeptics performing this service by talking about cold reading and the methods that the sort of street corner psychic will use when they're really just trying to get into someone's wallet, and that being a service, and I agree with that, number one. And I was just going to say, number two, and there might be some people out there still doing this on the, quote, you know, pro-telepathy side, but I wish they did it more. I feel like that's a ground they just sort of cede to the skeptics. And I think that when I look at historically what the old Society for Psychical Research did, in which they really did play both sides of the fence, I think that was really admirable. And there's so few people on the pro-telepathy side now that I guess they don't have time to really, you know, play both sides that heavily.
That's
but sometimes
right.
I wish they did. You know what I mean? Sometimes I wish they did, because the kind of effects that they've documented with hundreds and hundreds of studies are very different than what, you know, there's a psychic out at this in Philadelphia last night. I was out to dinner at some really sort of high-end, you know, shopping center where people gather and stuff, and there was this big Lux psychic shop with the crystal ball in the window and the $10 entry fee, meaning that, you know, they're going to speak to you for 30 seconds and try and hook you in for $10 and then tell you they can tell you more for $20 more than that. And I wish that the pro-telepathy people maybe did a little more work to try and expose that and talk about that.
Yeah, maybe. I hear where you're coming from, but it does lead me back again in terms of, you know, what are the larger implications for your book, for Fringeology, and for the finding that you have? And I guess I'd look at near the end of the book when you kind of sum it up and make where you want this thing to go. And I was challenged by that because on one hand, you know, you say, can't we find a middle ground between Richard Dawkins and Pat Robertson, I think was the example mm-hmm. you gave. And is it really Pat Robertson versus Richard Dawkins? Because I get the sense, and it took me a while to really figure this out, is it's Pat Robertson, Richard Dawkins against the rest of us.
I would agree with that, but I don't think that that precludes what I'm saying. I mean, look, when I talk, I think most of us are in the middle, Alex. I mean, I think most of us sit between Richard Dawkins and Pat Robertson. And I think that...
But see, now you're coming over to my point. If they're on the same side, then it isn't a middle. And I think that's what we've been sold. And I think that's what throws us and why we keep engaging in this debate, in this dialogue. And it's the wrong debate.
I would be slightly inaccurate, though, to say they're on the same side, though, right? I mean, because Pat Robertson is talking about a god and an afterlife. Life and all these things, and Dawkins is denying all those things. So they're
no. Pat Robertson is talking specifically about a god that fits very conveniently, squarely into the materialistic culture that we've developed, because that god only existed 2,000 years ago, only did these supernatural things 2,000 years ago in Israel. You know, that's the only place it was. And so Dawkins, even though he likes to do this little fight with the Pat Robertson Christian, it's a sideshow, is what I'm suggesting to you. Because the full implications of what you're talking about is that we have to go beyond that. It's, again, this chasm thing that I talk about, is that, hey, we're led by the evidence, jumping over on the other side of the chasm, realizing all these things that are different about these big, big questions about who we are and how we really fit in. And now we have to figure it out. And I'd suggest that your book tells us that we can't really look to Pat Robertson, but neither can we look to Richard Dawkins. So we're really out on our own.
Yeah, and look, I think we're involved in a semantic argument almost there, right? Whether we think of them as being on the same side or as opposing sides. The fact is, I don't think that I'll still refer to them as opposite poles, right? Absolute certainty of a specific kind of God versus absolute. And then look, Dawkins can say whatever he wants about not being absolutely certain. He behaves like somebody who's absolutely certain. So I find his claims totally disingenuous, right? So absolute certainty that there is no any kind of God, right? Versus absolute certainty of a specific kind. We're the rest of us can't line up with either of those people. And so we are either in between them or against them. However you want to phrase it, I'm comfortable with either, Alex. I mean, at the end of the day, fine. And I think that people who read the introduction and follow all the way through the book will see that is what I'm saying, that there's got to be an alternative to this debate that we always see in the media, right? This is the way it's always put toward us in media accounts, that it's this kind of religious fundamentalism versus science. And I think that there are areas in our public life where that pops up, right? In debates over evolution and creationism and what we're going to teach kids in school. But I think for the vast majority of us, trying to figure out how to get through each night, right? Trying to figure out how to live our lives, it does us a real disservice when this is the only debate we get to see, right? That when we turn on YouTube, this is the sort of thing that we're watching. And, when we check in on any of these new atheist debates with Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris versus whatever, religious figure they've chosen to pillory this week, that doesn't serve us. There's got to be something between those things. And that's why I even start pointing toward like a figure like Sam Harris, who in some ways is, really controversial and strident new atheist figure. But even he, I think, by acknowledging the amount of mystery still in the world, by acknowledging that contemplative prayer and meditation work, by acknowledging that dogmatic religion doesn't serve us, but that doesn't preclude spirituality, right? Even a broadly defined spirituality. There's some middle ground, what I would refer to as middle ground, or let's say common ground, that starts to get illuminated, a place where we could all stand and try and figure out what it really means to be us, what it really means to be human, why we're here and where we're headed. And that's what I was trying and straining to get at in the book.
Well, I think you'll definitely push a lot of people in that direction in the book. And it was it definitely challenged me and pushed me in that way. And so I don't want to sound too negative, because I felt challenged. I felt like the guy who's going to buy the suit. So he's saying, hey, this doesn't fit over here, not quite here, because he's really going to buy it,
Mm-hmm.
But the one other aspect that you touch on in the book, but I wanted to pull out a little bit, because I think even in that very nice summation that you just gave there, or that nice way of understanding this position that we find ourselves in when we accept this new information, the one factor I'd like to deal with head on is deception. Because you really do uncover, and you touch on, that there is a deception going on, and it's not just in the place that we'd normally think, like you were talking about the gypsy fortune teller who's clearly deceiving you. But when we look to science, we don't expect to see a deception. We don't expect to see a spin. Mm-hmm. And yet, as you reveal, and as we've talked about so much on this show, there really is an organized effort to deceive us.
Well, are you specifically referring to sort of the psychop stuff and the material on Randy and the degree to which the professional skeptical movement, if I just read them, I would think that people studying parapsychology are new age nuts who are, praying to some sort of divinity and using healing crystals and all this stuff, right, that we associate with new age thinking. And when I went to Seattle and saw the parapsychology conference, I was stunned by how down to earth the people were. When I surveyed the Parapsychological Association and got the responses back and saw that the majority of them reflected a more atheistic viewpoint, I was surprised by this, because even as a guy who was skeptical of skepticism, you know, I figured they were right about that, right? they must be right about that, but they weren't. They weren't right about that. Right. And so I think there's a great degree to which the public is generally lied to, that somehow this is all of a piece, right? That telepathy research is akin to Bigfoot research, is akin to believing in, what's the name of that, Ramtha? And it's not, period, end of story, you know? And the fact that guys like Wiseman and French have been pushed to admit that by the standards of any other area of science, right, telepathy, just that whole field, the Ganzfeld remote viewing, all of it, is proven. And they're usually even careful about using a word like proven, because you said earlier, in science, nothing's ever proven. But the fact that they'd even sign off on that and only rely on the extraordinary claims defense, right, that psi is an extraordinary claim, therefore we need greater evidence, just shows you the degree to which an organization like PsyCop is engaged in propaganda, right, and trying to paper over a problem they find uncomfortable.
Okay, but we do have to push that a little bit further, and Richard Wiseman is a perfect example, as is Chris French. Mm-hmm. But take Richard Wiseman for a minute. Is that really a genuine confession or a genuine admission on his part?
Oh, yeah, I think he had a moment of weakness, Alex.
I think it's another gamut. What's that?
I think he had a moment of weakness. Yeah.
No.
I think somebody slipped him some sodium pentothal. But anyway, what were you going to say?
No, I think it's another gamut. I think it's another play, because then he comes out with his book, which we just interviewed him and Rupert Sheldrick on, and he completely, he just lies. He just lies. He just rewrites the story, rewrites history, and goes back to his old account. You know, when we had Susan Blackmore on to talk about near-death experience research, and she's probably the most often cited real near-death experience researcher who happens to be a skeptic. And so she just admits all this stuff. No, I'm not a researcher. I'm not up to date. I shouldn't be regarded as an expert. And then the next month she goes to a conference and she just repeats all her old stuff. Or you take the near-death experience science as it's reported in the mainstream science. And we've just continued to expose this. But there is something at play here that keeps things going in a direction. And we can step back from the conspiracy and say, well, there's no one really behind that. But every time you look, it looks more and more like there maybe is something behind it.
Well, I think there are market forces and politics behind it at the very least, right? I mean, these are people. What I find particularly hard to trust, right, is when Blackmore says, oh, I'd love it if somebody would prove something paranormal. Really? You'd like to be shown up that for the last 20 years you've been fighting on the wrong side? That's what you want? I don't buy it. And so I sort of lost my train of thought there. But I mean, so I think what you're doing is you're laying on, right, other layers of deception that exist out there, and I agree with you.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, you don't have to go much past market forces and the status quo and maintaining it to understand a lot of what's going on. It is interesting to speculate if there is more, but I guess we'll have to leave that for another time, because the last topic I wanted to talk about was my personal experience with the book, you know? In my life, I've had just a little bit here and there of a lucid dream. And I read your last chapter on lucid dreaming, and it, lo and behold, it sparks something in me. It's a great chapter. I go to bed, and I have a lucid dream.
Great.
And there's a little technique in the book that you reveal, and I'm not going to tell people what it is, because I want them to buy Fringeology and find out for themselves. But I can tell you personally, I had the most vivid, amazing lucid experience I've ever had, and it was because I used that little technique in the book. So I really have to thank you for that.
That's terrific. I'm really gratified to hear that, because for me, I wanted the book to go from these kinds of controversial traditional paranormal topics to things that like meditation, prayer, lucid dreaming, that sit inside another context of just sort of, you know, spirituality and religious practice. And what I found in looking at those is that whereas with the paranormal, it tends to be something that happens to people, right? And that always sits in this little territory of like, well, how do I frame that? What do I do with it? things like lucid dreaming, meditation, and prayer, these are things you can practice. These are things you can do. You can sort of like, it's like, I don't want to say it's like a candy machine because it's not that easy, right? But you put your quarters in and you do get a result back. And that's really beautiful. And I wanted people to have something in the book that they could walk away with and keep for themselves in a really practical way. And so that's one of the things that so appealed to me ultimately when I started practicing lucid dreaming, was that it gave me something I continue to use.
So Steve, what's coming up for you in the near future with Fringeology, and what do you plan on writing more on these topics?
I've got an appearance.
Kind of hard, given that you just published it last week, I know.
Yeah,
but
no, I mean, the reason I'm hesitating is because, look, here's the thing, right? I've got, I'm going to promote this in every way I can, because I really do feel like, I really feel like I've come up with something that is fairly unique in the field, right? Amongst the titles, that isn't purely based in argument. A lot of it is storytelling. And I feel like too often we ignore what great stories these are. And so I feel like it's unique in that respect. And I feel like it's unique in the respect that it really does try to find that middle ground or common ground between the people arguing on either side. And I don't feel that many of the books really do that. And so those were my two goals. And I hope that I hit them. I'll leave it to other people to decide. And moving forward, then, that means I want to do everything I can to promote this, interview with everyone who's willing to interview me, and all of that. But then in the future, Alex, it's like, well, my next book is going to include meditation and lucid dreaming still, because it's going to revolve around fitness, and some of it's going to be physical fitness and some of it's going to be mental fitness. But I'll beyond that, there's not going to be like, you know, telepathy and ghosts and UFOs like there is in this one. Now, past that second book, who knows? Let's see how this one goes. Let's see what kind of reception it gets. Let's see what kind of reception I get, right? Because there's some risk involved in being a mainstream features writer who takes on this kind of topic. And let's just sort of go from there. I am not opposed by any stretch to doing Fringeology 2.
Great. That'd be a good title. Well, Steve, it's been great having you on. You've really brought so much to us with this book, and we do appreciate the interviews you've brought to us in the past. Thanks for joining us today on Skeptico.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
Thanks again to Steve Volk for joining me today on Skeptico, and I certainly wish Steve the best of luck with his book. I hope he comes back and does some more interviews for us here on Skeptico. In the meantime, if any of you are interested in picking up this discussion and carrying it forward, please join us on the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. There you'll also find links to all our previous shows, email, Facebook link to me, and a place where you can make comments directly about the show on the website. Thanks to all of you who continue to support the show, send me nice emails, recommend the show to your friends, and blog about us. Really appreciate that. I have several interesting interviews coming up. They just keep rolling along, and I can't wait to bring them to you. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.